Hello, everybody, and welcome to Patriotic Weekly Review, episode number 367. And we're live here tonight on Rumble and Odyssey. So please do share the stream. It's going to be a big one. We've got a lot to speak about tonight. Obviously, the big issue is the murder of Henry Novak and the sentencing of Vikram Digwa. The sentencing of Vikram Digwa is in the news, and the reaction from the public has been immense. People are generally very, very angry about this. So we've got a lot to discuss tonight. And I've got a great guest with me. Everyone knows who it is, but I'll be introducing him shortly. I'm sad he's not on camera, actually. I'm a bit annoyed that he didn't join me because he's grown this beard. He's a bit of a ladies' man, and I was hoping that he was going to show me up with his excellent dress sense tonight. But he hasn't done that, so slightly disappointing start there from Nativist. Should be showing us how it's done there, mate. Anyway, I've got a load of things happening this week, and I've done a load of things already this week. So if you check out the chat, look at the linked top comment that's pinned in the chat, and also look at the description of the video. I now have a Substack. I produce two long analysis essays every week, Tuesdays and Fridays, and these cover a range of topics. But at the moment, I've been focusing on these legal cases where people are quite confused to why they're working out in the way they are. And on Tuesday, I published a long essay, over 4,000 words, on the conclusion of the Manchester Airport brawl trial and why both of the trials collapsed and what this means. Now, a lot of people have been going, two-tier justice, mate. It actually isn't two-tier justice. It's worse than two-tier justice. It can work hand in hand with two-tier justice, but it is something different. So if you were interested in that fight at Manchester Airport between the police and the Muslims and wondered why both cases collapsed, check out my Substack. You can also subscribe to me there, and you can give a monthly recurring donation that helps me out massively. If I could get sort of a couple of hundred people, 200-300 people on Substack donating just $10 a month, that would make a world of difference to me, and I'd be very appreciative of that. We have made good progress there, so if you want, go and help me out there. Also, I am not just content with writing that one article. Today, I've been penning an extensive legal analysis of the sentencing of Vikram Digwa, the man who murdered Henry Novak. I've gone through the judge's sentencing remarks. I have looked at legal precedent. I have looked at the law. And I've also looked at comments being made by MPs and influencers about the sentence and pointed out where people are going wrong with this. A lot of people are saying this is a liberal judge. Well, I can assure you it's a lot worse than a liberal judge. This is a case of two-tier justice at its worst. That's all on my Substack, and it's all free. So go and check it out. One article out on Tuesday, and the sentencing analysis will be out on Friday at midday. Lots to dig into there. I've also been with Patrick Slattery on Monday and with Dr. David Duke tomorrow. We've got a stream on Friday and we've got the Nationalist A team on Sunday. So anyone who's saying that we don't work hard enough here, we certainly do. And there's lots of good content coming out soon and lots to take sink your teeth into. Now, if you like my work and want to help me out, please do consider sending a donation. You can go over onto Substack, check out that good work, and you can subscribe there. Or you can subscribe on Rumble or send a super chat on Rumble. Any super chats with a message that is applied or attached, we will read them out in the second half of the show. You can also donate via crypto. All the crypto links are in the description below. And finally, you can write to me at mark@thefallofwesternman.com. And remember, everything I do, it's free. Let's keep it that way. I've never put anything behind a paywall. If you appreciate that, please do support me. Now, one other thing, and people are going to be saying that I'm cucking, right, when I say this, but I want to make this point early before I bring the guest on. If you are out protesting in Southampton tonight or this weekend, please act respectfully, act lawfully. I know the police are our enemy, but don't attack them, don't assault them. Don't make it easy for them to demonize this cause. And I mean that in all seriousness, this isn't me cooking. It's me trying to keep people out of jail. And it's also me ensuring that the police and the government don't have an excuse to shut down the growing White Lives Matter movement. Anyway, we've got an amazing guest with us here tonight. It's Nativist Concern. He's one of the sharpest content creators in the Anglosphere. He's a travelling rootless Anglo who circles round the globe finding interesting stories to report on and getting into interesting scrapes. We always love to hear from him, especially when he's on the film club. He has some amazing takes on the modern dating scene, and he has just started an incredible show called Continuum with another friend of this channel, which is Keith Woods. The show is fantastic. All his links are in the description below, and I urge you to check it out. I will say one thing, though, Nativist. I kind of found that Continuum was a little bit like PWR, just not as good. And the hosts weren't quite as visually pleasing as the PWR host. How do you react to that criticism?
Well, we did try our best on the outfits. And I think some of the girls particularly enjoy Keith. So, you know, we'll leave it up to the audience there. I'll tell
do
you what, though.
Do the girls like tall beanpole men now? They're kind of like the muscular 45-year-old Chad dad. Am I sort of out of vogue with the ladies now? Is it more about the thoughtful, tall, slim, thinking man rather than the push-up obsessed dad man?
I'm afraid twinks are in at the moment. So, you know, it's like the Chalamet era. But yeah, I remember you used to put up some good numbers on the old weightlifting and that. So yeah, you just got to bow out gracefully, I guess, Mark.
Well, you know, I'm happy to hand it over to a new generation of men. And you and Keith are doing amazing work. You know, I love you both. Joking aside, the show's absolutely incredible. I've shared a few episodes and a few clips, and I urge everyone to check it out. It's required viewing. Anyway, Nativists, so let's get into the big issue of the day. And I'm not going to show it because it's particularly harrowing. And I don't want to put it up here and potentially get the show age restricted. But the body cam footage of Henry Novak's death has been released. And for one, it's quite harrowing, not just because of what happened, but because you realize you are actually watching a young boy with his whole life ahead of him die in front of you due to a killer from an ethnic minority background and the police who essentially assisted in the murder. How did you feel when you watched that body cam footage? That's if you have, I'm assuming you have, but.
Yeah, I did watch it. It's about what I expected, to be honest. By the way it was described, I felt like he had been so mortally wounded that the police wouldn't have even been able to save him. I guess he was probably lying there for 10 or 15 minutes while, you know, that family were lying on the phone to the police, trying to cover their tracks and, you know, hide the murder weapon, etc. So, yeah, I guess it had an extra significance for me because I went to university in Southampton. And, you know, I was trying to put myself in the shoes of the police and, you know, maybe they would have believed the lies about him being drunk. Because, you know, when I was there 15 years ago, a lot of students were often drunk on that kind of route and they were falling asleep in people's gardens and stuff. So I think, you know, possibly they would have bought into those lies because of the situation of the student nature of Southampton. But yeah, I had a couple of friends message me who aren't, you know, really in the scene, but they're aware of what's going on. They're just not willing to, you know, be involved, and they were, you know, up in arms about it. So I think there is a broader tension brewing in the UK, and people just realise that, you know, we are third class citizens. We're not even second class. We're third class citizens in our own homeland now.
Well, I think it's actually worse than that, mate. I often describe things in this country as being a sort of ethnic totem pole, and to say that we're second or third class would be sort of overestimating our importance to the state. I mean, really, when it comes down to it, we're bottom of the pile, aren't we? You know, top of the pile is obviously the guys with the small hats. But underneath them, there is a whole number of different ethnic groups that rank higher than we do. And this case has really illustrated that. But for me, I've watched a lot of things over the years that people have sent me. But the body cam footage of Henry Novak has to be one of the worst things I've ever seen. Watching him plead for his life and explain to the police that he'd been stabbed, only for the police to be like, I don't think so. Don't think so, mate. You know, get on with it, more or less. Absolutely horrific. Now, I don't think it's unfair to say, I don't think the police would have treated anyone from another ethnic group with that level of callous disregard.
Yeah, absolutely. I just get the impression now that white people have been so brainwashed, you know, from the cradle with this morality of, you know, basically laying down our lives for the benefit of outsiders, that it becomes a kind of neurological loop where you have to disprivilege yourself and your kin in favor of outsiders for fear of being, you know, cast as, you know, the most evil person alive. And that thought process and fear runs through the mind of every white person every day while they're, you know, living in this culture.
I mean, what we're seeing here, though, how much of this do you think comes down to police training? Because I wrote an article that went pretty viral. It was one of my Substacks. It's had 13,000 reads, which I think is pretty good for a relatively small channel there. But that article suggested that there was some sort of police training in action here. And I think there was. I think when the police hear the word racist or hear an accusation of racism, something kicks in and they do something, they act. Whereas if that accusation isn't there, well, you'll get a completely different response. And I think when they heard Vikram Digwa say, I've been the victim of a racist attack, this guy is a drunken racist who attacked me, you know, it was unprovoked, I was walking home, he pulled my turban off, dragged my hair into my eyes, and I had to fight him off. I think the police immediately acted upon that due to their training. And the officer's callous disregard was because he thought he was dealing with the worst of the worst. He thought he was dealing with this drunken racist. He's not allowed to dispute this. He's not allowed to say to Vikram Digra, are you sure? You better not be lying. You know, look, mate, I want to hear your side of the story before I put the handcuffs on. It was immediate handcuff time. Now, that to me seems pretty insane, that a guy's being handcuffed immediately on the say-so of another guy without any evidence, without any witness testimony, just immediately, you've said he's racist, get the handcuffs on. That must be, if not an explicit directive, some kind of implicit rule that's drummed into every officer. They might not have actually put it in writing, but it's implied so heavily that officers do it on command.
Yeah, and the murderer knew what to say on the phone. I think he said racist attack in like the third or fourth word. It was right up front. And then he weaved all his lies from that starting point. But the shocking thing for me was one of the female officers noticed the level of peril that Henry was in and said he's got a mouthful of blood. But still, the actions of the police didn't react. They were still going through this, you know, a bureaucratic protocol where you do it in this order. And they're not even allowed to think on their feet. It's this just, you know, liberal bureaucratic mindset of doing everything step by step. And yeah, I mean, if the situation were different and the injuries weren't so bad, those anti-white policies, which have been put in place, it appears since George Floyd in 2020, there was a, you know, increased level of this kind of diversity training or whatever. You know, his life may have been lost in that window if the injuries were less severe. So, you know, this is literally costing the lives of white people. And, you know, anyone you speak to that has any kind of job, particularly in the public sector, but also increasingly in corporate jobs as well, you know, this diversity training is standard. And they're given these videos where you're meant to, you know, nod your head as white people are cast as the colonial villains that have, you know, capable of infinite evil, and all these other people, these angels that can do no wrong. And, you know, everyone, well, I've spoken to at least 10 people that have had this kind of training, and they just say, yeah, it's just a day. You know, you pretend to be taking it in, you tick the boxes and give the right answers, because otherwise you'll lose your job.
You see, a couple of things that really got me with this is, as you said, the woman says, look, he's got a mouthful of blood. His hand was going white. He was obviously protesting, and all they had to do was lift his shirt up. He'd also got, you know, he had 4 stab wounds, but he had a slash to his face as well. So he was bleeding from the face. And I think this really illustrates how systemic two-tier justice and anti-white bias is. Because when you looked at him, all evidence was pointing to him being in real trouble. And you don't have to be a police officer or a paramedic to understand that pale extremities, blood in the mouth, you know, a guy panicking, pleading for his life, those are serious, serious signs that something's wrong. And I don't know if you ever watch body language analysis. So if you do, you'll see that people who analyze body language will pick up what are called tells. But they say, look, if you get one of these tells at any one time, you can't read too much into it. You know, if somebody starts blinking, it could literally be that somebody on the side of the room has just turned a light on, or, you know, shone a phone torch at them, and they're sort of like, but if they're blinking and doing 2 or 3 other things, it's called a cluster. So any one thing on its own can be written off and is not usually seized upon by body language experts. But when more than one thing happens at the same time, that's called a cluster. And at that point, a note is made that somebody is acting in a way which is in line with being deceptive, being asked a line of questioning that they're uncomfortable with. And this helps detectives zone in on the sort of things they should be asking. Now, I know this is slightly different, but this wasn't one thing. It wasn't that he just had really white hands because he may have been a guy who drank too much that night and had a circulatory problem. It wasn't just that he had blood in his mouth and, you know, they might have had a fight and he fell over and knocked a tooth out. You know, it wasn't just that he was saying, oh, mate, I've been stabbed and he's drunk and he doesn't really know what's going on. But there was a cluster of things all happening together. And that cluster should have been, as a group, so heavily identifiable by any officer attending the scene. But even as a cluster, everything was dismissed because he was white and because his attacker was a Sikh and was shouting the word racism. And this tells you two things, really, doesn't it? The first is that obviously young people from an ethnic minority background absolutely know how to play the race card. But number two, people within powerful institutions are taught to accept the race card. Do you know how it was actually they first got on to the fact that he was definitely lying?
No, go on.
So in the sentencing report, and this is very important. So this is actually all being proved. In the sentencing report, which has been released and is in the public domain and that I'm producing a report on right now, this isn't actually part of my report because my report's about the actual sentencing. This isn't part of the sentencing, but it's important. Him and his brother were both arrested at one point and put in a police car. And by this time, the police were a little bit like, well, we're slightly suspicious of him and his brother. And they requested the right to secretly record him and his brother whilst they were in the police car. And him and his brother immediately started talking in Punjabi. Okay. And admitted to his brother, and it's on record, that he was going to lie and say it was self-defense. And this was all admitted. So this guy had actually, you know, concocted this story, and his family were going along with it. So it is absolutely unbelievable just how much this young Sikh lad, who's only 22 when he committed this horrendous offence, but how much he knew that playing that race card would absolutely give him the best chance of getting off with murder. And this was a family affair. You know, it was his mother was involved. His father was involved. His brother was involved. I know the mother and, you know, the killer were actually charged. But this is directly from the sentencing report. Point 23. Thereafter, the time came when the police needed permission from a court to extend the time for you to be questioned in custody and arranged for you and Gurpreet to be taken there for that purpose. They took the opportunity to record secretly any conversation between the two of you on the journey. Speaking in Punjabi, you agreed to pretend you had acted in self-defense, even though you confessed to stabbing Henry three times, including once in the chest with a dagger. You knew you were guilty, demonstrated by your saying to Gurpreet that if there were any cameras in that part of Belmont Road, you had been able to put forward self-defense. You decided, much as you had at the scene, to try to cover it up. In all your police interviews, you decided not to answer questions about the incident. Instead, you made a written statement which told more lies. So this was a full-on ethnic cover-up job, not just involving the killer, but involving his mother, his brother, and other family members.
Yeah, I think that's particularly egregious to white people because, you know, most white people would never forgive their own immediate family members for doing such a heinous crime. And you've even seen the likes of Madeline Grant, who's the editor of The Spectator, making those kind of comments. So even the people at the very top of the Anglo establishment are starting to get the idea here that these clans from Punjab, from Mirpur, they will cover up each other's crimes without any remorse whatsoever. And just as well, the officers did have the foresight to record that. You know, we can't say they were completely incompetent. But yeah, on your point on, you know, the wider discrimination, I've just remembered something. A friend in the civil service told me, I think it was 3-4 years ago, a new female manager came into the department, and she basically said, we're not just going to be listening to white men anymore. So that's the kind of institutional discrimination that's going on. They, you know, they put in these diversity hires, HR departments, and they will say those kind of things in the very top of the Anglo establishment. But it's not working out as well as they might have hoped.
So what was your sort of gut reaction when you watched this, when you heard that what had happened, then you saw the body cam, and the body cam for me was worse than I imagined it. But then you found out that it wasn't just him and his mother. This was a family affair. I think this really lets people know that the degree of in-group preference these ethnic minorities have basically means they will cover up the murder of an innocent person to protect their own. And like you say, I don't think that's the nature of white people. I don't think white people would do that. I mean, I think most white people, if they thought their son or daughter had gone out and killed somebody in cold blood, they wouldn't be supporting them.
Yeah, we're very individualistic, you know, minds with a broad, you know, morality, which allows us to build very complex societies across a, you know, a large group of people. That's basically why we've been so successful as a civilization. We stopped marrying our cousins. Christianity broke the clan structure of England. And for 800 years, we've had this eugenic and high trust course. And, you know, in the last 80 years, these foreigners that have been marrying their cousins have been brought into our civilization and given special privileges, and they can't maintain our standards. You know, if any British man, his friend admitted to him that he'd raped a woman, he'd go and shop him in the next day. I can say that for the overwhelming majority would do that. And it was something as, you know, serious as murder. You'd shop your own family members in for that. And that's how we operate. That's why we're such a successful civilization. But it's all gone too far, and we're, you know, forced into killing ourselves. Like the morality of becomes suicide to accommodate these people that can't match our standards. And I think it's all coming to a head. People are realizing that, you know, it's completely incompatible. You know, these mega liberals like Merkel said a decade ago that multiculturalism's failed. But big ships turn slowly, and, you know, people are starting to get the idea of how incompatible we are. But, you know, we need to be patient and keep pushing the message.
Yeah, I agree with that. And let's move on to pushing the message. I think you made a very good point. And I think one of the interesting things with white people, I just wanted to add this. You said no one would look after a family member over the issue of murder. But I think sexual crimes are even more taboo amongst whites. So I think if you asked white people to sort of rank criminality, I think they would rank sexual crimes, especially crimes against children that involved some kind of you know, sexual motive, I think they would look at those as the worst of the worst of the worst. And I don't think there would ever be that kind of cover-up amongst normal whites. The only sort of cover-up there ever is involving sex crimes is establishment stuff. And, you know, from deviant sexual minorities. You know, unlike when you get sort of like the Muslim community, where the Pakistani Muslims, as a group, including women and extended family members, they'll get on board with that. I don't think that would have happened within white communities.
Yeah, crimes against children are so completely beyond the pale that a lot of white people would do it themselves. If someone they knew had done those sort of crimes, they wouldn't be able to contain themselves. Like, nothing lights up British people like crimes against children. So, yeah, I think you're absolutely correct there.
But you brought up something that I really wanted to move on to, and you kind of sort of segued into the next section of the show. And you said, you know, about the message and about getting the message out there. And I've got to say this, and I say this with some pride. I saw Nigel Farage say white lives matter. And then I saw Robert Jenrick say white lives matter in Parliament. Now, it wasn't that long ago that Patriotic Alternative started the international White Lives Matter movement with our Indigenous Peoples Days, where we had people all over the Western world putting up banners, posters, and even doing artistic displays that said White Lives Matter. Can you remember the massive banner drops at MAMTOR? Can you remember Sam Melia flying White Lives Matter banners from the side of York Tower? People all over the country flying drones, abseiling down cliffs, putting up posters, putting up placards. It was massive. And when we did that, we were crucified, and I personally paid a massive, massive price. I've been deplatformed, permanently banned off X, debanked. Michael Gove wanted to create a list of legal extremists that could basically, if you're on that list, it would more or less affect your life in a number of sinister and largely invisible ways. You just find you couldn't do certain things. You wouldn't know exactly why. And we were going to be on that list. I was going to be top of that list. I was like the big bad guy. And for saying what? White lives matter. Now everybody's saying white lives matter. And Farage saying it, Jenrick saying it. It's the phrase. White lives matter, guys. Well, I got crucified for saying that. Now, look, I'm not saying that, you know, I take all the credit, because there was a lot of people who got behind the PA banners. There was lots of people who put up that banners. It was an international effort. Laura, Sam, yourself, many others. You know, we had help from people in America. We had help from people all over Europe, Australia, New Zealand. It was fantastic. South Africa as well. But the fact is, when you look back at this, we started the fire. And when we started that fire, we were persecuted. And now it's the cool thing to say. Now it's the thing everyone's saying.
Yeah, I remember that final hike up Mam Tor, and then getting the banner out for the first time. That was a great moment. I also remember having the same banner and being attacked by Antifa at Trafalgar Square at 7 a.m. in the morning. You know, it's just so surreal that you can be at the center of London, you know, at the next to the National Gallery, at the monument where our greatest warrior stands, being attacked by, you know, whatever it was, 10 black bloc masked up retards with their own camera person trying to get us on camera fighting back so they can say, oh yeah, they did an assault because they're the nasty fascists or whatever. But yeah, you know, great memories all the same, and all credit to you for you know, being an organizer that we can trust and so consistent and all of this stuff. And you know what a difference we've made. You know, Nigel Farage is trying to keep it together. He's trying to, you know, bring it back to Martin Luther King values, but no, we need to keep pushing beyond that and save our homeland. So yeah, things are moving.
Well, look, I'm not here tonight to have a go at Nigel Farage. Certainly not. He said white lives matter. In fact, I can't stand Robert Jenrick. Robert Jenrick's one of those guys who brought all the Afghans into Britain, and I can't stand him. But I'm not going to have a go at him for using my phrase. The people I am having a go at is the people at X, the people at Facebook, the people at YouTube, who banned me for bringing that about, for basically saying, let's have, you know, when me and Laura were saying, let's have an international day of White Lives Matter. You know, we were the guys that were basically, you know, the bad guys. We had to be squashed. I mean, I posted something up today, and you might remember this, mate, because you were there. And look, I want to just say something here, right? I don't really get emotional about having guests on. I'm not going to start bawling or crying like some tit. But like, I do love Nativist. And I love Nativist because throughout everything that we've done, Nativist has not only been consistent, but he's also been loyal. And he's been a little bit like a little brother to me. And I do love the guy, and it is great to have him on here tonight discussing with us. And look, if you can help him out by, you know, helping him with Continuum and his work, do, because he is a guy, you know, loyalty goes a long way. And people over the years who have stabbed us in the back, Nativist has never been one of them. And Nativist was here on this particular day, and this will probably bring a smile to his face. But can you remember this? And it's from a local paper. Right-wing group who unfurled huge banner reading White Lives Matter from the top of Mam Tor have been branded abhorrent by Hope Valley councillor. That was our first White Lives Matter, but you know, big White Lives Matter thing. And at the time, you know, we were just getting started, And it was so sort of difficult because we were getting we were doing everything we could to get the, you know, the word out, get the message out, and to make it so that, you know, people knew who we were, and we were being crucified by people. And there was this little sort of counselor somewhere, this busybodying counselor, went berserk, you know, making a comment to the local paper. And there we were on the top of Mantor with this giant banner, and all you could see was cheeky little grins above it and lots of sets of legs beneath it. But that was a day I'll never forget. And boy, you know, despite being crucified for that, have we been proved right?
Yeah, your glee is infectious, Mark. You know, even when you're a seasoned nationalist, you feel a little bit naughty getting out the slogan White Lives Matter, because you've been trained your whole life that this is, you know, completely beyond the pale. But yeah, it was a great moment, a great community feeling. I loved just after, when Laura was sharing the article from whatever local paper it was, and she was sort of quoting, you know, the usual words that they use. And it was just great. I think a lot of those people that kind of bought the high of white hate in 21 and 22 are feeling very stupid now. I mean, there'll be a lot of hedging going on as the Liberals try and realign what they meant and what they stood for at that time. But, you know, I'm quite forgiving, but I can always rely on Mark to remember exactly who needs to be brought up and who needs to be charged with, you know, crimes against the nation when the time comes. So yeah.
Marky C's big book of traitors that he remembers. I've never forgotten any of them, mate, from the year I've gone. I always remember those that were loyal, and I always remember those who weren't. So there's a ledger, and on one side is the good guys, and on one side is the bad guys. But the people who started PA, you know, back in those days, it was so infectious, wasn't it? Going up that hill. And when I remember that first time when we went up that hill and I got out that banner and everyone was so excited, and it felt, you know, it felt like that sort of like a moment in a film, you know, where Bane says, you know, they say to him, like, have we started the fire? And it's like, we really did feel like we were starting something big. And I've got to admit, for a few years, the White Lives Matter thing died down a bit because Black Lives Matter sort of disappeared. But to see the fire rise like it is at the moment, it's unbelievable. And look, I would love to be down at those protests in Southampton. I would love to be there with the PA people and with the White Lives Matter banners. But, you know, again, we've said to people, please, please, you know, don't go down there and get involved in any trouble, because one of my big concerns, and I don't want to be a Debbie Downer, is PA have always kept it legal, respectful. We've always had our code of conduct. Although we view the police as an arm of the state, we are polite and respectful to police officers, despite what they do to us. But I've got to say, one thing that does concern me about all of this is if the lads kick off in places like Southampton or other places, I don't want them to use these new anti-protest laws to shut this down. Because what we've got to remember is, since PA started, there have been these gigantic power grabs, this new legislation that's come in that prevents people from carrying out repeat protests. If a police commissioner says, look, there's been too many protests in this area in a given period, and we believe that any further protests, regardless of which side is protesting, you know, are not conducive to the public good. What do you think about that, mate? Because we're not cucking, but we want things to be done in a way that stops them clamping down. What I don't want is another series of arrests like we had after Southport.
To be honest, I haven't had a detailed look at the new laws that were passed in relation to protesting since, I think it was 2020. So I don't know exactly how it's changed, but I certainly agree with you that, yes, you know, make your protest known, get down there if you can, but stay away from any of, you know, getting too close to the police, allowing them an opportunity to be aggressive in the first place. I think that's what happened yesterday. The police started attacking the front row with their shields, and then people behind were pushing the front row even further in because they were just there for the ruck. And then you've got all these other people there that just want content and they're provoking things. You know, I firmly believe that we will win if we have and we present the right ideas in the right way, and we give that message to the people to the extent that they will it into reality. You know, it comes down to the power of the ideas, the credibility of our marketing, our heroic deeds, and the, you know, the will of, you know, enough people to create a consensus to make a change. And a lot of these people, they're not capable of thinking about the ideas. They're just angry and, you know, they want to make a scene, they want to get famous, but a lot of that is wasted energy. So, you know, make your thoughts known, be there, but, you know, stay away from trouble and don't, you know, go out looking for a fight as always. And, you know, your advice is always the correct one on this.
Thank you. So I've got to say, I've been really impressed by a number of MPs on this, and not just Nigel Farage and Rupert Lowe. Nigel Farage has been really good, saying White Lives Matter. Rupert Lowe's been excellent as well. He's actually called for the death penalty for Henry Novak and has stated that if Restore formed a government, they would seek the return of the death penalty for people like him. Well, that's really is something big to suggest, you know, the death penalty. But we've also had Suella Braverman come out and attack the judge, saying that the sentence is too lenient and she's leaning on the attorney general to review the evidence. You know, Robert Jenrick, as much as I dislike him, you know, has come out in Parliament and said White Lives Matter. Now, I know not all of these people are our friends, or if we called them our friends, they'd be friends to differing degrees. You know, you have your closest friends, then you have that guy down the pub that you have the odd game of pool with. And, you know, occasionally you'll share a beer with him if you're watching the footy on the same day as he's in there. So there are differing degrees of sort of friendship, or, you know, and some people aren't even friends, they're just acquaintances. But we do seem to be seeing a lot of people that are, you know, tangentially connected to us, because they're no longer in the Conservative Party or they're nominally to the right of the Conservative Party, coming out on our side. But I do like to... sorry, did I say the death penalty for Henry Novak? Sorry, I meant the death penalty for Vikram Digra. Sorry, that was a slip of the tongue. He's called for the death penalty for Vikram Digra in the case of Henry Novak. Sorry, people in the chat just said I got that the wrong way around, which I did. Slip of the tongue there. My apologies. But what I'm saying is I've seen this kind of big, big level of sort of a big shift to the right for many people. But I don't know if you've actually seen the other side of this. Because there's been a massive amount of pushback against Nigel Farage, Rupert Lowe, Suella Braverman, a huge amount of pushback against the narrative that Vikram Digra has got a lenient sentence. There's a lot of people on X, and I'm talking people getting hundreds of thousands of likes, for saying that this isn't the big deal that, you know, we rightfully believe that it is.
What I would say about this reform clique that you're talking about is cast your mind back to when Suella Braverman was Attorney General, and there was a young lad, he got charged with Section 58, which is a range of books that, you know, are a bit naughty. But the state has deemed that if you have possession of them, you know, you'll likely be sent for prison and cast as a terrorist, and you'll never be able to get a job again. But you know, a 1 in 100 judge, he, when faced with this case, he let the lad off by saying, you know, you made a mistake, go and read a few of the classics, Jane Austen or whatever. And when you come back for sentencing, when he came back for sentencing, he's basically said, you know, suspended, you don't need to go to prison. Now, that case was referred to Suella Braverman. I believe it was by the Campaign Against Anti-Semitism, but if it wasn't, other Jewish lobby groups. And she sent him to prison. She is married to, believe it's Raoul Braverman, who is a Jewish Zionist. Robert Jemrick is married to a Jewish Zionist. Nigel Farage, biggest donor or second biggest donor, is Paul Marshall, who's married to a Jewish Zionist. And this clique are quite willing to engage in white identity politics to bring the attention to them. But should they win the election in 3 years, all that energy will be used, I believe, for the purposes of Zionism. They may make some amendments to the law, you know, take the boot off the neck a little bit, possibly withdraw the Equality Act. There are rumors that are also going to repeal the Communications Act as well, which would be beneficial. But, you know, I firmly believe that we should be always trying to outflank them, push it further, criticize them for cucking, bring up what they've done before, you know, Jemrick with the Afghans, Braverman's role as Attorney General, and just really keep the pressure on. And the leftists, the type of leftists that were shouting down Farage, if there's this internal war on the right, those people will be outflanked as well, and they will increasingly be seen as irrelevant behind the times. And I don't know if you saw today, but Rupert Lowe called for Tony Blair to be charged for what he's done to this country. So, you know, I know we have a slightly different opinion on how UK politics is progressing, but I really believe we can use the Restore vehicle to really push the agenda. And I'm liking this competition between Reform and, you know, people further to the right as well.
Look, I am. And the reason I'm bringing this up is not because I'm all of a sudden a supporter of Suella Braverman. In fact, in my article, for anyone who reads it on Friday, I'm actually quite scathing of some of her suggestions, because I point out that, you know, she wants to alter sentences, but the sentences are a reflection of the system. It's the system that needs altering, not the length of the sentences. If the system was set up in the way it should be, we wouldn't have poor sentences. Poor sentences aren't just a result of some liberal judge. They're a result of a system that allows a liberal judge to pass a sentence while still working within the lawful framework of the sentencing council. This is an important thing to point out. The reason I'm happy that Jenrick and Braverman and Lowe and Farage and many others are starting to use terms like White Lives Matter and talk about this is because I'm a firm believer in the idea that once the genie is out of the bottle, it's hard to get it back in, if nigh on impossible. And once you have these phrases said in Parliament, it becomes very, very difficult to then prosecute people on the outside for saying them. So, for example, Robert Jenrick is no friend of ours. And of the Conservatives, he was one of the worst. He was one of the guys that oversaw that scheme to bring in Afghans. You know, I believe around 40,000 Afghans have been brought into Britain so far via that scheme. And he was one of the people who wrote an article on his website that was published in The Telegraph championing that scheme. And he went as far as to say that he was going around his constituency asking people to help these Afghans. Completely unacceptable. He's not our guy. I don't like him. I've campaigned against him. I've campaigned in his constituency against him with a demonstration. So, you know, I do not like this guy, but he has done us a huge favour, because he has. There's nothing wrong with the term White Lives Matter, but by using it in Parliament, it becomes so much harder for groups like Hope Not Hate or, you know, a particularly liberal police chief to pursue people like us for using that legitimate phrase. And you've got to remember at one point, you know, his fellow Tory MP, Michael Gove, was all for, you know, basically criminalizing that phrase via the back door. So, as I said, I'm not cucking on this. I'm not saying that these people have come good or they're now our friends. But it is useful that they are using our terms.
Yeah, well, we'll see how it develops. I think particularly the action on X is driving Farage further. I mean, you can kind of witness it in real time. People keep dropping these montages of Farage cucking. You know, I'm in the process of making one myself, and I keep, you know, putting these clips up. But yeah, I've been rewatching these old interviews of Farage where you know, his whole idea is basically we can bring the empire back together to live in peace and harmony in the United Kingdom. And it's all going to be fine as long as we have a broad understanding of our history as the British Empire and our liberal values. But I think, you know, that will basically get washed away because the conflict that's already ongoing is already too intense. There are too many radicals in the spaces that he's trying to occupy on X. And if you watch the comments on, you know, him and his team, they just get absolutely rinsed by our guys. And then you get, you know, radical statements from Rupert Lowe and other influencers now and again. So it's all too heated for him to be able to contain it. And I just think, you know, the liberals are going to get totally lost trying to keep this together. And, you know, every single article, every single event that gets posted, you know, people are saying, what about Southport? What about Manchester? What about Henry Novak? So the public have become aware of this kind of discrimination very slowly. And it's at this point now where the system can't really contain it. And, you know, there will be these pressure releases. But, you know, I don't think Nigel will be able to contain the pressure himself.
Now, today, Nigel Farage has actually used the issue of Henry Novak in the by-election that's taking place in Makerfield. Now, I don't want to get into that by-election because I've done an entire video on that the other day. So I don't want to do 45 minutes on that again. But do you think this is a big enough issue to affect the public psyche to the degree it could change people's voting habits or even bring people out to vote? Because there's two things, isn't there? The first thing is, will people who do vote switch their allegiance? That's one thing. But then there's also the issue of, will people who don't vote ever be brought back into the game? Will they ever get off the bench and come back and vote? And could the Henry Novak issue or the murder of Henry Novak be one of those motivating factors? Because, you know, I've discussed this a few times, but Tommy Robinson's Unite the Kingdom wasn't that successful this year. Now, at the end of last year, it was wildly successful, but that was on the back of the Southport murders. Now, I think if UTK was being held this weekend coming, I think you would probably have double the number there than turned up a few weeks ago. So we know these events do have a massive effect when it comes to turnout at these sort of big, you know, whether you want to call them CivNat or sort of, you know, nationalist light gatherings. But do you think this may have an effect on elections too?
I will raise you on that prediction, Mark. I think Tommy's thing would have been 5 or 10 times bigger. It really is kind of luck of the draw with the kind of things that are in the news cycle, the kind of clips that get shared and the kind of clips that reach, you know, the average kind of conservative person that tries to stay away from from politics, but every now and then something gets put in front of their face and they're so incensed that they can't help but, you know, go out and be part of it. But yeah, I just think the conversation has got to such a critical mass now through everything that's gone on. Obviously Southport being the biggest one, but you know, a long line of, you know, Islamic terror events and discrimination, and particularly young white men that have been discriminated against in the labor market. They don't feel they've, you know, are able to make anything of their lives, and they're increasingly online. All of that coming to the fore is, you know, is driving the conversation. And yeah, there will be people saying, you know, people that would have voted Conservative, actually, I'm going to vote Reform because it needs to be a bit harder. Like, you know, racial identity is important. And then through the conversation, people will be going to vehicles like Restore. I mean, obviously, economics is king. And, you know, the Green Party message will probably resonate with, you know, particularly the under 40s, people that don't own property. But you know, that's a kind of, you know, slightly different thing. That it's a mixture of, you know, economics and general culture that will motivate people. I do think there will be a general tilt into the right, because, you know, the Liberals are just losing the moral argument. They're losing the credibility of the high status opinions, and they're not going to be able to keep a lid on it. So things will shift.
I hope so. I mean, one thing I will say, and I don't want to be defeatist, but often these things cause a little bit of a pop, don't they? They cause sort of a big blip. Almost if you're watching sort of an ECG and you're seeing the sort of line go out and all of a sudden it goes blip like that. These things do have that effect where they cause a spike in interest. And we saw this around Black Lives Matter. I mean, I've seen this with this show, you know, around the time of Black Lives Matter, then around the time of Southport, you do tend to get more views. You know, you can produce something on a topical issue and it gets a bizarre amount of coverage because everyone wants a take on it. And then a few weeks later, you return back to your sort of regular level of support and viewership. And this is one of the things that sort of does always concern me. It's the third today. We're 2 weeks out now from the Makerfield by-election. And I wonder where we'll be in 2 weeks' time. Now, obviously, the anger over Southport kind of persisted for months. And I don't have a crystal ball, but I can see this rumbling on for quite some time as well. This seems to have really sort of grabbed people's attention, quite most notably because, you know, one of his one of the last words of Henry Novak was "I can't breathe," which is identical to what George Floyd said, but things have been dealt with so very differently. Do you think this will be something that has a lasting effect on people like Southport, like the grooming gangs?
Yeah, to a lesser degree. I do think, you know, the visceral nature of that clip, and you know, just the indignity with which Henry died will stick in the minds of everyone that watched that clip probably forever. And then around that you've got, you know, the various crimes of Afghan illegal migrants that have gone on in the last few months. You know, the girl that was raped by two Afghans in their 20s, Wayne Broadhurst, who was stabbed to death walking his dog. There's been an Afghan rape gang discovered in Norwich. So people are being shown these kind of articles on a very regular basis. And increasingly women are starting to speak up about how they feel about navigating the multicultural environment and the measures they have to take to secure their own safety. And you're now even at a stage where you're getting hit pieces on female influencers in the nationalist scene by the likes of the Daily Mail and other papers. And it's now being seen as a normal position to be a white nationalist in favor of mass deportations. So, yeah, I think, you know, all these things will stick in the minds of people, and they'll increasingly be brought up in real life conversations and, you know, people sharing their concerns. But, you know, what's driving this is the sharing of clips, the sharing of news articles. That's how people are living their lives now. That's something we spoke about on the last episode of Continuum. It's all about what propaganda you can make in a moment that is shareable for people to share their concerns with their friends. It needs to be in line with, you know, how they're thinking at that time, but push them a little bit further each time. And I've seen my friends go through this, you know, people that were giving me liberal arguments and Zionist arguments and all these kind of things in 2018, 19, 20. And then in the last couple of years, they're coming back to me and they're talking like I was in 2019 or something. And I'm like, oh, this is insane. Like, you were the biggest liberal I knew like 6 years ago, and now you're, you know, asking me about all this law on, you know, whatever. So yeah, things are moving along, and it will stick in people's minds increasingly.
I certainly hope so. I hope this is, again, one of those turning points that wakes people up. And I'll urge people on this. I know you said you're going to do this, but I urge you against it. That at the moment, some people are sort of spending their time making like, oh, look, here's the Farage cooking supercut or whatever like that. You know, at times like this, I sort of even try to lay off the sort of anti-Tommy Robinson stuff, because we're at such a point here where this particular issue, I think, this is one of those uniting issues that take precedent, and we should aim all our firepower, ideological firepower and recruitment firepower, at the public here, rather than sort of saying, well, don't support this guy who's kind of saying the right thing, support this guy who's slightly more based. Or I think at this point, all firepower needs to be aimed in the right direction. We need to sort of ignore some of the sort of the more, to the public anyway, minor disagreements we have with others, and just be like, look, think about what this world is going to be like in 25 years. If this is happening now when we're 70%, you know, in 25, 30 years, when we're 55, 50, 49%, what's it going to be like? I think now, instead of fighting over the people that we've already got reading our stuff, this should be about bringing in the apolitical. Now, look, I'm a bit of a negative guy about this, because I've done a lot of knocking on doors, and I understand how hard it is to get people who have fallen out of love with the system, or checked out, or who don't engage with voting and politics anymore, back into the system and back into politics. You know, once people have said, I'm done, I'm going back to normie land, dragging them back into politics is hard. But the reason I urge people to aim everything they've got at the public now, rather than at sort of negging Nigel Farage or Tommy Robinson, is mainly because I think this is one of the few incidents like Southport that can actually get people off the bench. This is one of the few times where people who have said, I'm going back to normie land, turn around and say, why am I sitting on the sofa watching football and eating goyslop when this is the issue of the day? You might disagree with me on that, but I think this is one of those few times where differences should kind of be put aside and everything should be aimed at the disillusioned normie in an effort to get them off the sofa or out of the pub and on the sort of political trail. You know, back in my day, I always remember, you know, getting people out of that pub on Champions League night when they all wanted to be sat in the boozer downing pints and watching, you know, their favourite English team playing in Europe, getting them out of that boozer and delivering leaflets was always a difficult thing, and that's what I want to see. And I might sound a little bit like I'm being idealistic, and often I'm not, but I think this is the time for that. I don't know if you've got anything final to say, Nativist, but then we'll go to questions.
No, I do think you're right. We do have a responsibility to manage these different groups. We want our own vanguard to have a consensus, be aligned, work together, drive the algorithms. But we also have a responsibility to, you know, let these less radical people influence the masses in a broader way. It's about, you know, managing the Overton window as best as we can with it within our power. But in the case of Nigel Farage, I do really think it's important for Restore to put up a big percentage in the Makerfield by-election, just to announce themselves, just to say, actually, no, your return to British Empire, liberal values, multiculturalism, 500,000 Commonwealth citizens in per year, which he will brand as net zero. But that's something important to bear in mind, that the reform plan is literally to bring in, you know, 2.5 million Commonwealth citizens during their term, you know, by which point the white British birth rate or total fertility rate will, you know, be less than one, and we'll make up, you know, 47-46% of births, something like this. So I want to, you know, hold his feet to the fire, let people know there's another option, and really try and get organized without flanking reform, talking about their Zionism, talking about the need for mass deportations. I accept what you're saying. It's a responsibility on us to, you know, control the conversation between the radicals and the normies. And of course, we've got the World Cup coming up, so we're going to endure a 4 month of multiracial propaganda and being told that Jude Bellingham and Bukayo Saka are Englishmen, and, you know, how brilliant they've done to make the final when they missed their penalties, and, you know, all the terrible racists that turn out to be Arabs gambling 3,000 miles away. We've got all that to come, and it's about taking advantage of the situations, you know, when the news cycle's in our favour.
No, I definitely agree. And what you've just said is actually a worry. You can imagine, England doing well at the footy, and people are being like, oh, forgive and forget. You know, we got to the finals of the World Cup again. Let's put this behind us. Oh, God. You know, as if putting a piece of, you know, silverware in a trophy cabinet somehow undoes all the terrible thing that's done to our people. But that is what happens. Anyway, let's do the super chats. If you haven't super chatted yet and want to contribute to the show, please do. You can super chat through Rumble, or you can go on over and check me out on Substack. That's another way that you can help me. So please do help out in any way you can, and please do check out my Substack at the end of the show if you haven't already. It's free to subscribe, but you can become a paid supporter. All super chats are very gratefully received. Mr. Milos M gave $2. Thank you so much. Said, greetings. It's a pleasure to see Nativist on PWR. I always enjoy listening to his takes on the female psychology on the film clubs. And then he gave another $3 and said, also, as Nativist is still in Serbia, I follow him on X, and he made a few posts recently about his experiences. It would be nice to go on and have a pint or two with him one day. Where are you at the moment, Nativist? Can you tell us?
Yeah, I mean, I'm in Serbia at the moment. It's a country I'm very fond of, very, very white, very Christian, very, you know, it's an honor-based familial society, and people are very friendly here. It's a lovely place to be. And I'm really glad that I've had the opportunity to travel to these different places. And I think it's helped me come to sociological conclusions about what the perfect society looks like. And I've learned an awful lot from places like Serbia and even Japan. I'll be bringing those ideas forward in the coming episodes of Continuum and my writing. So, Yeah, maybe I'd have a pint with a random if, you know, if they've got some kind of proof that they're not a Fed or something, and that there's a link there. But yeah, I'd encourage everyone to travel to the Balkans if they can. It's very nice and traditional.
He's definitely not a Fed. I know him, and I know people have actually met him in real life. So he's a decent guy. And yeah, you needn't worry about him being a Fed. He is not. He's a decent fella. And if you want me to put in touch with him, I absolutely will. Because it'd probably be good for you to go and have a drink with him, and he could show you around. So if you guys want to meet up and have a date of sorts, I can help facilitate that. I've had an amazingly generous super chat from No Casa Worries, and he gave $500. Well, thank you so much for that generosity. That is absolutely incredible. Obviously, I can't thank you enough for that. And he said, "Hi, Mark. I said I would fix the $20 if I ever caught you live. Apologies again for the hassle regarding the Substack subscription refund. Your articles are excellent, by the way." Well, you more than made up for that, and I can't thank you enough for that kind of generosity. And obviously, you've got my email if you want to write to me, if you want to correspond to me. I can't thank you enough for that level of support. You know, something like that to get the month off to a flying start is just unbelievable. So from the bottom of my heart, thank you so much. Please do get in touch. Well, actually, I'll email you and thank you personally. But if you ever need anything, or if you ever want to reach out to me, or if you're ever in England, pop in and see me. You'd be more than welcome to come over for Sunday dinner. Nativist has actually been to my house for Sunday dinner, haven't you?
I have indeed.
My wife cooked you two separate roasts, didn't she?
Was it two?
Yeah, wasn't it? It was a roast chicken with pork with.
Oh yeah, yeah, pork belly. Yeah, yeah, the pork belly was class. Yeah, yeah. No, she's a great cook. She's lovely. Always love it in the Colette house. Yeah.
But yeah, you only met my daughter. You've not met my son yet, which is disappointing. If you ever get back into England, you'll have to come and meet the boy.
Yeah, I'd love to. Mini Colette. I'll bet it'll be a terror when he's two.
Mate, he's already a terror now. He's. I tell you one thing, though. And this sort of does shock me. He's more of a mummy's boy. And more of a mummy fan than his sister, actually, which is quite interesting. He really is a little mummy's boy. He's massive, but he is a mummy's boy, which I find quite amusing. He's certainly if he has the choice of being able to just sit cuddled up with mummy all day, that would be his number one desire. So there you go. But I was a bit of a mummy's boy, and I turned out okay. Horatio Hornblower gave $5. Thank you so much. He said, "Mark, have you ever watched the videos of TIK History on YouTube? He covers World War II battles and other topics." I haven't. Have you ever been aware of TIK History?
I don't remember it by name, but I do watch quite a lot of those history videos on YouTube, and they do tend to be great. Yeah, you can waste like 2 hours like watching videos about like random Napoleonic campaigns in Italy and Russia. It gets quite addictive, but yeah, I definitely recommend them to people. You pick up little bits on them that are really interesting. I mean, well, one of my favorites was about Richard the Lionheart's crusade, and in one battle on the way to Jerusalem, he had dysentery, and he got his men to carry him on a platform whilst he just lay there with a crossbow into battle. So, yeah, I love that bit of lore. And, yeah, I'd recommend the channels.
Well, I've just looked up TIK History, and it looks amazing. It's all about World War II, fascist ideology, real deep dives on things. I might check that out. I've got to say, I have become, I wouldn't say addicted, but since they brought in these YouTube shorts, I can waste a lot of time watching these little 1 to 3 minute shorts on fascinating topics. So the other day I found myself watching a video about shoe shining, followed by a video of the best baseball bat that can hit the longest distances, followed by how tarantulas molt, then a video about these blue pit viper snakes that breeders specifically breed for their colors. And on it went and on it went and on it went. And I've got to say, I don't want to say that I'm kind of becoming like addicted to these things. And I understand there's a lot of slop out there, but I always remember before the internet came in, I really loved shows on Discovery that used to just deal with quite mundane things. So they'd say, well, you know, how do that? There'd be an entire hour long documentary on how jam got made. And I'd be absolutely glued to it, from the picking of the and sorting of the fruit right through to how they purified it, put it in the jars and shipped it to stores. And I found those things quite amazing because it seems mundane, but the actual logistics of an operation like that is huge. And these YouTube shorts, I do find them interesting. And you know, I'm not watching what some people watch, so like, you know, slime making and, you know, clothing haul try-ons, but actual interesting stuff. It just draws me in. And for some reason, well, actually, I know what it is. My missus is terrified of spiders. And at this time of the year, she's constantly shouting me to come and get spiders from around the house. And I've been bombarded with videos about the life cycle of different spiders. I didn't even know that there were blue, actual turquoise blue tarantulas. But I find it absolutely incredible that there are, and now I know their life cycle, which is just insane. I don't know whether you've ever fallen into this habit. It probably is a bad habit, but I do just love accruing knowledge on a vast range of topics.
I think I might have walked past one of those blue tarantulas in Greece before. Well, I've always been a sponge for knowledge and enjoyed learning. I read the encyclopedia when I was a kid, and I watched a ton of documentaries, you know, war ones, engineering ones. And one of my biggest gripes with the BBC was how they basically got rid of the documentary. There's, apart from the nature stuff, which is politically neutral, you know, they got rid of so much history stuff and, you know, British pride, you know, as a theme, our engineering history and things like that. And I guess the kind of shorts ecosystem is now filling the void in a, you know, very addictive format, which may not be the best for our neurological circuits, but it's the way everyone's living now. I'm very critical of it, actually. I think it does harm our brains and kind of it kind of disconnects us from context and time horizons, because it really reprograms your brains to kind of seek out the next little hit of dopamine, because the dopamine kind of rewards you for seeking out something that's has an irregular reward pattern. So it's something to be aware of, but you know, the internet is fulfilling a need that's kind of been taken away by other forces, I would say.
Yeah, one of my guilty pleasures, there's a guy on YouTube called Baseball Bat Bros, and this guy, he stands there in these baseball fields at night with all floodlit, and this guy just hits home runs, and the sound of the ball dinging off the bat and going flying out of the stadium. I don't know why, but I find it incredibly satisfying and cathartic to watch. I don't know why, but so if anyone likes what random stuff, Baseball Bat Bros, he's an interesting guy. Despite me being interested in this, I don't think I'll ever do it, because it's one of those things that looks really cool when other people do it. But I can imagine that if I tried it, it would be an absolute disaster and I wouldn't be able to hit it as far, and it'd be an abject disappointment for me. Anyway, Seager88 gave $2. Thank you so much. Said, Nativist, please learn Keith the basic etiquette of unbuttoning the suit jacket when you sit down. It messes with my brain. I must say, your continuum you do look really smart, both of you. And I love the studio where you do it. Is it actually all done live and properly recorded?
Well, we kind of set it up ourselves. It took us like 3 days to set it up and get all the gear. So before we go live, I'm kind of running around and pressing the buttons on all the cameras. And, you know, we kind of just go from there. The super chatter, I'm not sure if they're male or female, but they've been hammering the comments for a few weeks now. You know, it was perhaps a mistake. I personally prefer it closed always, just because I like the V shape at the, you know, on the chest. But yeah, Keith was on to me about not realizing, and it's, you know, it's because I haven't been in a corporate environment for my whole career, so don't know the rules. Unfortunately, you've got to wait another 3 episodes before we make any changes, as they've been pre-recorded. So there you are.
People are now giving me oh no, it's not clothing advice. He said shorts are trash. I think he means YouTube shorts. Well, it could, that either could apply, because I live in cargo shorts and I am watching YouTube shorts. So both could apply. I think you and Keith have got a good rapport, and I do like the show. One thing I really enjoyed actually was your recent takes on the effects of tablets and mobile devices on young children. And I think there is quite a lot of, you know, good academic information that you put out on your show. Both you and Keith are surprisingly well read for much younger men, and you speak with kind of a confidence and authority which is you know, usually found in men of a much more senior age. I think it's really good stuff. I mean, that particular segment of the show, I shared that on my Telegram. I thought it was brilliant.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, I mean, we were researching, you know, just a few hours before, and I just stumbled across this stuff, like on Ofcom official data, and there was another poll of 1,000 UK parents, and I just thought it's incredible, just how bad this has got. What was it? 32% of parents are having to show their child a tablet to let them eat. 43% need to show them a tablet to get them to, you know, stop crying. And, you know, I experienced it firsthand watching my own friend's child have a tantrum over his screen time. And I've seen it in other friends of mine, you know, young children, their nephews, nieces have been given the tablets at 3-4 years old. And, you know, smart countries like Sweden and Norway have just completely banned this electronic equipment in schools now, because, you know, they've seen the data. And I mean, it's quite interesting that like very liberal left-wing socialist states like Denmark, they're now doing the empirical research. Has immigration actually helped us? No, it hasn't. Okay, we're going to the ECHR. We're going to change the definition of Article 3 and 8, and we're going to say sayonara to these people. And they're leading the way with tablets as well. So, you know, these kind of nations have taken a lot of heat from us for being, you know, at the forefront of liberal ideology. But, you know, they're turning back and realizing mistakes now. So, you know, hopefully the rest of the West can admit mistakes on issues like immigration and too much technology in people's lives.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting, because when you actually look at people who homeschool, it kind of, there's four major groups. And one of those groups is the very unfortunate group of children that have been kicked out of schools that probably come from very sort of rough families that don't get a good education, you know, either in school or out of school. But there are also people, you know, from the left, the right, and sort of religious groups as well. But it seems that although those three groups have very different ideologies and thoughts on the world, all three of those groups are united over one thing, which is essentially the rejection of screen time, tablets. And I don't know if you saw, but a while ago, I posted up a study on my Telegram, and it was actually about computer games. And it stated that when we were younger and we had games like Super Mario Brothers, they actually helped us with our patience and our concentration, because you had one game, you had to practice, and if you weren't good at it and didn't get good at it, you didn't play anymore. Whereas now, it's quite the opposite. As soon as you're not getting instant gratification from whatever you're doing on the tablet, you just get to download another game at will, start that, and when you don't like that, you dump that. And it's led to children having too much choice and never being able to commit to anything. And obviously, you're a bit of a, you know, psychologist when it comes to the fairer sex and the dating game. And I often wonder if this idea of too much choice and not sticking with anything for a long period of time will go on to affect the mindset of young people when it comes to dating or when it comes to choosing a sexual partner.
Yeah, that's been spoken about for a long time. Illusion of choice theory is, yeah, it's become a massive part of dating now, and women are allowed to kind of refine the segment of men that they deem acceptable through the illusion of, you know, infinite choice on the dating apps. But I think the whole dating app ecosystem is just so utterly broken. I've been willing these boards of these companies to, you know, improve the service. For a start, they need to enforce a psychological analysis of people and force especially young girls into analyzing their compatibility, like the type of partner they should be with, because at the moment it's just very image based. And you know, because it's all online, it's just totally devoid of any social proof or social status. So there's so much time wasted on these pointless dates with people that you aren't compatible with, and it, you know, it's a huge part of the whole family formation process and the continuation of our stock. And you know, people suggested someone like Elon Musk could buy these companies and sort them out. And frankly, I hope someone that is willing to solve the problems does.
I'm not really sure that problems can be solved now without a complete reset. And I see this a lot because obviously having two children of my own, you see how other people bring up their children. And the problem is, human nature is all about taking the least path of resistance. You know, if you're offered the easy way or the hard way to do something, most people will choose the easy way. So, you know, if you offer people two options, you do it the hard way, it takes longer, and there's less initial gratification. But in the long run, you learn a skill and become a better person. Or you get pretty much what you want immediately, learn very little, but it's a lot easier. Most people will take that least path of resistance. And unfortunately, taking the least path of resistance is something people do with children. And it is difficult. You know, if your kids are sitting there at the dinner table saying, I'm not going to eat this, I don't want to eat this, and kicking off, it's so much easier to give them something they want from the cupboard rather than saying, well, you're not getting up from the table until the shepherd's pie has been eaten. You know, you don't want the kickoff. You don't want the screaming. You don't want the moods and the tantrums, but you do want the shepherd's pie being eaten. But if you want your kid to value good food and be healthy, you've got to eat the shepherd's pie or you're not getting up from the table. And I think most people, especially after a long day's work, and this is one of the big problems in modern society, is mums and dads, more often than not, both work now. And when they come in after a long day, neither want those big arguments with their kids. Neither have got the energy to be parenting. And I'm sure when my dad came in from work, he didn't have the energy for parenting. But my mum was a full-time housewife, so she did. That was her job. And I think part of this problem is down to the insidious nature of the technology that surrounds us. But also part of this is down to the fact that parents are more worn out than ever before, because the system has made it so two parent families, you know, aren't a stay-at-home mum and a working dad, but are two working parents, because otherwise they can't afford to keep the house going. It's all a big problem. And I'm pretty sure it affects people in multiple ways. And the people who come out of it the most negatively affected are, in fact, the children. I don't know if you've got any final takes on this.
No, definitely agree. If I can just share, I've walked through London suburbs around 5, 6 p.m. when, you know, the commuters are coming back, and these women in their late 20s, early 30s just look completely worn out. And you just think, I'd much rather if you had a couple of kids at home and you spent your energy on them rather than, you know, some London corporation. And, you know, we need to completely redesign society. And I think something like giving married men with dependent children tax cuts would be a great way to reform the economy and, you know, continue family formation. Because this hyper competition between men and women is just so destructive to society.
Yeah, I agree. We've got another very generous super chat here with a question for you. It's autism is unstoppable, and you gave $50. Thank you so much. He said, great show, Mark, and thanks for all you do to help this community. And he asks you this, Nativist. He said, do you think dating is easier or harder for men than it was 15 to 20 years ago?
I think dating for men gets harder every year. Yeah, I mean, it's a bit of a long question to answer, but the big issue now is that, like, young girls, the kind of girls you'd be interested in, are just so addicted to TikTok. They don't go out much anymore. They're in hyper-liberal sisterhoods, and they are basically filtering out men that have a masculine disposition in many cases. So it becomes a case, you know, if you are a masculine man, a traditionalist and a nationalist, you're forced into a situation of searching for women that have that kind of background, that kind of father, because they're the ones that are going to be attracted to you for your beliefs, for your protectiveness, and all that kind of thing. So the politicization of women and the technology they're using are just huge barriers these days. And that's why so many men are struggling. And unfortunately, a lot of them are turning into kind of like spiteful gender wars rather than an analysis of the mechanisms that are going on. I mean, I'm very blunt about it, and I don't really care if I get called incel for, you know, making comments. But I'm really just trying to solve the problems because I've experienced them, and I feel like I understand what's going on.
I'll say this. Things were different in my day, and they were different in both the online and offline dating world. Firstly, everyone wanted to find a partner. And secondly, when you met a girl online, if you went out and had fun with her, it was almost like immediately she was your girlfriend, and that was just a done deal. Whereas I think today, the thing that hurts people is, firstly, people have generally less polished communication skills. And secondly, men and women have never been at greater odds than they are now. But I think this affects middle class people more than it affects working class people. I've talked about this before, but where I live is a very white working class area. And I hear a lot of middle class guys say to me, well, I can't even talk to a woman. I've never been with a woman. I've never managed to even ask a girl out. And I'm like, well, how does that happen? Because in my area, you only have to go to the local park, and there's massive gangs of young lads with massive gangs of young girls all holding hands, all interacting with each other. And they're not people who are stuck in all the time. They're people who are out. They're out on their bikes. They're out at the park. They go to the fair together. I'll give you an example. Me and the family went to Cleethorpes during the half term. We went for a day at the seaside. It was a good day. And on the way back to the car, there must have been about 50 or 60 youths standing by the beach. They were all white, mixture of girls, mixture of lads, couples flirting with each other, messing around, having fun, totally natural. But Cleethorpes is a very sort of, you know, Grimsby, white working class kind of area. But when you speak to these middle class lads, I think the computers and the screens and their kind of almost autistic hobbies have really sectioned them off from women. But I don't think this problem is affecting generally white working class people. And if you see white working class lads, they all have birds, whereas it's more the middle class lads who seem to be struggling. That's just how it is. And I think it's the difference in lifestyle and culture as much as it is the problems of technology and online dating.
Yeah, I agree. And when you get, you know, aspirational middle class women that are in the higher IQ bracket, they inherit the beliefs of the system. And then, you know, first of all, if you interact with them and you try and push your beliefs too quickly, she will basically just get scared. Because she's in her female brain, she's going to think, like, I've got to reimagine my entire being to be compatible with you. And then I've got to convince all my friends or hide my beliefs from my friends. So normally they will just, you know, reject a right-wing man out of hand because it's too much social pressure, too much risk of social ostracism. So at those, you know, higher IQ brackets, the women are just really system compliant. And, you know, some you will be able to convince, but your arguments need to be really good and circle back round to what lies deep within her. Like family life, and, you know, noble warriors ruling rather than these sneaky merchants. And you can kind of expose some hypocrisies in the system, and, you know, why that leads to a worse world. But, you know, you are up against it with, you know, most of these girls. And the further to the northwest of Europe you are, the worse it is, more or less. A lot of challenges.
Yeah, and I think as well, there is some sort of like snobbishness from some like middle class guys, and it's their snobbishness that doesn't serve them well. If you've got this snobbish attitude that your girlfriend has got to be, you know, university educated like you, and she's got to have a career path, and she's got to have ticked certain boxes, but you overlook, you know, the attractive girl that works at the sandwich shop where you get, you know, your sandwich for lunch every day, that's a big error. And I do know middle-class guys that kind of look down on the girl that works in the sandwich shop. You know, and their parents do as well. They're kind of like, well, look, I don't want to be with the sandwich shop girl. I want to be with the girl who's had the university education, whose parents have got, you know, a second home in the south of Spain and all that. But she, unfortunately, is going to be the kind of girl who grew up in a household where the woman having a career, the woman earning money, the woman putting her career path first was a big thing. Whereas if you date the girl who works at the sandwich shop, she basically just wants to cuddle up with a guy on a sofa at the nut on an evening and be like her mum and pump out five or six kids. It's a very, you know, it's a very foolish thing to try and chase that ideal woman that ticks all these arbitrary boxes, when there are women out there who they might not seem as good a catch, but their sensibilities are more down to earth, and a more down to earth woman is going to be more amenable to being a stay at home mum or only doing a part time job. You know, if she works at the sandwich shop, she's going to be at work from, you know, 7-8 in the morning till just after midday, home in time to pick the kids up from school and put the tea on the table. That might be a much better life than finding the high flying woman with the university degree and a giant bookshelf of impressive books, but, you know, wants one kid at most and doesn't want to raise it herself. There's lots of things to consider there. And I think that you know, men need to look at the kind of women they're going for and that they think they deserve. You know, that's that is a big issue. And also, if you want to find nice women, I'll give you a tip. I used to go to pubs and bars and things. Absolute nightmare. Tons of really beautiful birds, all of them drunk, all of them talking nonsense, dancing. Couldn't get to know them. You go and do a 10K run or a half marathon. You've got to be up at the crack of dawn on a Sunday morning. But the number of beautiful birds, all sober, all clean, all interested in self-improvement. They're the kind of women that if you met and talked to and said, you know, do you fancy a day out hiking? They'd want to do it. If you go out with, you know, if you go to sort of like the bar and club scene, you are going to find a type of woman that often is much harder to tame because the things that she enjoys, again, aren't particularly conducive to raising kids. Anyway, Nativist, you're the expert. So if you have any final words on this, hear thee now.
Yeah, you'll never find your wife out at night, but the kind of places you can check out now are the likes of like the hiking club, bouldering, art galleries, bookshops. And if you can kind of hone your cold approach skills and learn how to build a conversation whilst displaying value, then, you know, you've got a good chance, particularly if you can back it up with a social media page that, you know, has a few hundred friends, has some good photos and social proof. You know, that's how it's done outside the internet world. So that's what I'd say. That's the way to fight back, I would say.
Or you can be like me and take the hard path that I did and just be as unbelievably as noxious as possible to any woman that you come across until one woman finds it absolutely unbelievably sexy and is like, I've never had a man just ignore me and be such a beast before. For some reason, I've got to be with you forever and have your children. It worked for me, might not work for you, but I have got two children and my wife does do the best roast chicken you could ever imagine. So maybe being obnoxious and beastly isn't that bad after all. And Nativist can attest and has attested to the quality of not only the roast chicken, but also the pork belly. So there you go. Point gave $25. Thank you so much and said donation. Appreciate your continued support. Strawberry Lynn is back tonight. Thank you so much, my dear, because she gifted a subscription. Snazzy Candidate gave $8. Thank you, my dear, and said, hi, Nativist and Mark. And he said that word in Irish, which I can't pronounce, which is T-A-O-I-S-E-A-C-H.
Taoiseach. It's like their president or prime minister.
Yeah.
Taoiseach.
Oh, it said Taoiseach. Taoiseach. Prime Minister, including Hindu Leo Varadkar, serving two terms for 6 years. India's 1.5 billion population replaces our ratio at 20-1, 20 Indians to every one Briton. Yeah, it does kind of get annoying, doesn't it? When you see sort of white countries so willing to vote in these like non-white leaders. I mean, you know, I'm sure that Kemi Badenoch being leader of the Conservatives is just going to drive more people to either reform or restore. It is so jarring when we've been told all our lives that white people should never be in charge of, you know, a non-white country. But then you see the same whites who told you that cheering on a non-white to run our country. I've never got that.
The black pill is that the best Indians came to the UK in the 70s when they got kicked out of Uganda. They're the merchants. Their children became doctors and care home owners and petrol stations. And they've been very successful. But their children are now the likes of Rishi Sunak and the aspirational CEOs that are, you know, feel more comfortable in a diverse, multi-ethnic society. So, you know, they're intellectually capable and a threat, but the people they're going to be bringing in now are the Indian villagers that just have no comprehension of the West. And, you know, we're already starting to see Indians top the rape table rankings now. So, you know, that's what's happening. It will continue to happen with all these deals that the Indians are doing.
Yeah, I've got to say this. It is quite interesting because when the original Indians came over and took over corner shops and things, they were subject to what could have been called quote unquote racism. And those Indians, say there was a day like a bank holiday where we celebrated a royal wedding or something, those Indians would have so many flags up in their corner shop, and they did genuinely sort of either try to fit in or be forced to go back. And there was a completely different mentality then. But what we're getting now is, you know, not what we used to get. You know, any small benefits that one might have said we got from a small number of Indians back in the 1970s is certainly not what we see today. I totally agree. Hazelnut 3000 gave $10 and said, thank you both. Well, thank you so much. The Resident Baker gave $10 and said, evening, Mark. Good to see natives on the show. I'm surprised the system hasn't started showing repeats of the cricket, showing Monty Panzar in an attempt to quell the anti-Sikh sentiment. Look, mate, I'm going to tell you this now. Despite everything I said earlier about not rioting, if all that I could watch on any screen was cricket, that probably would cause me to turn violent. Nothing is more boring than cricket. Cricket is like the watching paint dry of sport. Nativist is going to hate me for that because he loves the cricket, but it's not for me, mate.
I've got some inside info on Monty Panesar. I think it hit the tabloids a bit, but he was a big drinker and got himself in all sorts of situations, let's say. So, you know, he's probably not the poster boy they would choose for that community.
Baba2 gave $20. Thank you so much, my friend. And he said, the important thing is that we all stay in the fight. We don't know what the watershed moment may be, even if there is one. This war may be generational. That is the advice I'm giving myself. Well, I agree. I've always said this is a generational conflict. And the idea that we should all be waiting for the quick win and the quick turnaround, I think it's a really bad idea. I've never been in favour of that. You know, let's turn it around tomorrow. And if we don't, let's walk away. And that's one of my big worries about things like the Makerfield by-election and other events like that. If Reform and Restore do sort of cancel each other out, my big worry is all we need is sort of a bump in the road where things don't work out. And people will just go back to normie land. And I know Nativist is going to disagree on that. But, you know, respectfully, I've been around a lot longer. And I used to remember that in the BNP. You know, I was there in the BNP in 2004 when we were predicted to win European election seats. And a month before the election, the government changed the way the election was run. And they actually brought in a system of postal voting, so everyone voted by post, which upped the turnout, and the BNP narrowly missed out on seats when they should have rightfully won them. Now, they never did that again. They never forced the postal vote again. But after 2004, a lot of people dropped out of the BNP, and the BNP went into a bit of a free fall because of the disappointment of the election results. You know, we didn't win at the GLA, which we were predicted to. We didn't win at the European election, which we were predicted to. And finally, it took us until 2008 to win one of those major elections. But all it takes is a bump in the road for people to sort of pack up shop and go home. And I really, really hope that we don't get that bump in the road, because I don't think there's many people as committed as the people watching this show tonight. Not many people realise this is an intergenerational struggle.
Yeah, I don't want to come across as like overly optimistic and, you know, in 3 years we're going to be well on our way to saving ourselves. You know, it's going to be an awful lot of work, and, you know, I'm really trying to work on the ideas that can shift the middle class, particularly in their thinking, because ultimately they are the power brokers. And in terms of the UK, the state, I think, may reflect on what it's doing and at least turn course somewhat. And I'm confident we'll get deportations of some kind if not in the UK, in other countries in Europe first. And I hope this thinking will become normal over the next decade. But certainly it's a long fight. But I feel quite confident about the ideas, and, you know, maybe even things like AI will totally transform society in ways that are hard to imagine now. And we will get that breathing space to have families and, you know, live among our own communities peacefully. So, you know, always try and remain optimistic, not delusionally so, but, yeah, you know, I'm not too disappointed where we are at the moment.
Yeah, I think things are on the up, but as I said, it doesn't take much to demoralize people. I've seen the cycle of boom and bust many times, and I don't want to sort of black pill people, but it does happen. Milos M gave a dollar, thank you so much, and said there's something in a spider's nature that seems very contemporary, especially if you're a male spider. Also, I'll be more than happy to sit down with the nativist. I will not forget my tape recorder. Ziga88 gave $2. Thank you so much. Said, I'm a 27-year-old male. When, if you ever have Tom Sewell on again, do the review of Apocalypse Now, please. Have Nativist on with him. That would be class. Hail Nativist. Love his content. Look, Tom Sewell's all sort of wrapped up in this Australian court case at the moment. So I don't know if or when he's going to be free again, which is really disappointing because I was really looking forward to it. But if you want, pester him and see if he will come and do it. I'd love to have him on. Obviously, Nativist would have been on. It would have been a good show. But at the moment, it's on hold. And, you know, we also don't know. So the NSN is basically banned in Australia now, and they're fighting for the right for the White Australia Party not to be banned. But the issue is, if they, I believe at the moment, or at 2 p.m. Australian time, either today in Australia or tomorrow. I think it's actually today. So in Australia now, it's about 7 a.m. So in about, 7-8 hours time, wherever abouts in Australia the court hearing was, we should get a result from the top judge in Australia as to whether the White Australia Party is immediately banned or can get relief and is allowed to be unbanned whilst it appeals the ban. So we'll see what happens. But Tom's very busy with that. But if people put pressure on him, he might do it. But don't annoy him too much because he's probably quite stressed. Reese Beast 310 gave $5 and said, great analysis as always. Thank you so much. Hallibut but gave $1. Thank you so much. He said, yeah, but life is always easy when you're the complete package. And then he gave another $1. And said the first Indians were probably the cream of the crop, to be fair. And then Ziga88 gave $5. Thank you so much. He said, Nativist, do you have any general life advice for men in their 20s that feel a bit stuck in life?
I haven't thought about this much, but, you know, in my 20s, I was really on my hustle trying to make excess money so that I could live a life of freedom, and I'm glad I did, because it's allowed me to contribute to the cause of nationalism without fear of losing my job. I've always kept up with the gym, you know, always keep in touch with your friends and you know, socialize, and yeah, I don't know. At this point, I would say don't spend too much time online and get out there and, you know, network. And, yeah, you know, I guess the thing that will really influence your life the most is finding the right partner. So the more you can invest in yourself, and, you know, be good at dating and, you know, have the desirable characteristics of a man, that's really going to affect your life outcomes the most. So focus in that area.
My advice is, as your life goes on, it gets much harder to sort it out. So you really want to get things sorted in your 20s. Now, if you don't, you can still get things sorted in your 30s, But if you don't do it in your 30s, it gets so much harder to do it in your 40s. And by the time you're in your 50s, it's probably impossible. So this is probably the most important part of your life as a man, to set that foundation. And my advice, if you're in your 20s, stop your partying, stop your drinking, don't indulge in drugs, don't smoke, get to the gym, get fit, indulge in something that both interests you and can make you money, so that you're free and you're engaged in something productive that you can gain from financially, and set yourself up. Because if you are looking for a wife, if you are looking to bring a family into the world, the best way to attract a partner is by being the best version of yourself. Now, look, you're not going to see results in any of those fields overnight. But if you stick at it, and if you set out a plan, in a few months, in 6 months, in a year, you will start to see real changes physically and mentally. And once you've achieved those things, once you've become the best version of yourself, I think from that point, you start to not only feel better about yourself, but you exude a confidence that attracts women. When you look rubbish, you not only look rubbish, but you know you look rubbish and you're unconfident. When you're happy, when you look good, when your life's in good order, you not only feel good and people see you feel good, but you exude this confidence where you don't really care. And I've kind of seen this from guys. I used to go out to pubs and bars, and you'd walk in there with a guy and he'd be like, look, I've broken up with my girlfriend. I really need to get out there tonight. I really need to just, you know, get off with a bird or bring a bird back and clear my mind. And his kind of desperation and desire to pull someone would almost be like, you know, kryptonite to these women. It'd drive them away. They'd be like, oh God, get away from me. This is awful. I don't want this. It's like, it's repulsive. It's a repellent. Whereas you'd have guys that were in a happy relationship with a beautiful girl, they'd walk into a bar not wanting anything to do with any other woman, not looking to pull another woman, just out there for a few beers with the lads and to have a good night. And women had swarmed them. It's almost like women understand when a man is looking for it, and that puts them off. Whereas a confident man who's got everything in order and is not chasing, that turns a woman on. So I think if you're happy, I think if you're successful, I think if you're the best version of yourself, that sets you up for everything else. And the best years to get everything in order are your 20s. And if you stick to that plan and you use your 20s to the best of your ability, you set yourself up for life. If you coast through your 20s and it's a bit of a car crash, you can sort it out in your 30s, but it's harder. But don't get to your 40s or 50s, you know, and be without the important things in life, because at that point, it's virtually impossible to turn it around. And look, there's nationalist influencers like that. There's nationalist influencers that we all know that, you know, have been like, I've sorted my life out, I've met a woman, and they end up having children. Then there's other nationalist influencers that are like, you know, still living 10, 15 years later as they were when they started making videos. And you're thinking to yourself, well, why did you squander it all? You're going to be in your 40s or 50s and you're not going to have a wife, and it's going to be so much harder to get that. Do you concur with that, nativist?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, between the ages of 27 and 32, men really start to diverge in terms of their value in the mating market. Like, the guys that did the work, they went to the gym, they developed their personal skills, they built a business, they have forward motion. They're the ones that just are just bombarded with choice. They have the option to go on 3 dates a week, you know. So yeah, it really is competitive around those ages. So you've really got to give yourself the best chance. I mean, you know, if you're socially isolated and you're a guy and you're around that age, join a martial arts gym, because there you're going to build up your manhood, your confidence, your connections and your fitness. So that's a really easy fix that so many men are involved in now. And they're going to share your political views in most cases. And I think like the martial arts franchises have really moved politics in the last few years, because these are real men that don't care about what people think of them, and they'll shout their politics in the microphone after they win a fight. So yeah, I'd say that as well.
Good advice, mate. Good advice. Well, that brings us to the end of the show. It's been a really powerful show tonight. It's been fantastic having you on, Nativist. You are the man of the hour. So wrap things up and have your final say.
Yeah, thank you for having me. Obviously, my big project at the moment is Continuum with Keith Woods. Please enjoy the show. You know, absorb the ideas and share it with your friends. We're really coming at things in terms of neurology, psychology, philosophy, economics, and really trying to break the back of academia, trying to break the back of liberalism from an academic perspective, a bio-realist politics. So please support us in that. Also support Mark in his new Substack. I've enjoyed the articles on there, particularly the analysis of the legal system and how it discriminates us and the kind of tricks judges will play to kind of hold this system together. So yeah, that's all for me. Thanks for having me. And yeah, people follow me on X at Nativist Concern. I'm pretty active on there, probably too active. So yeah, that's where I'll be.
Well, look, thank you so much for joining us tonight. Thank you to everyone who's been with us tonight. I'll be back later in the week. I've got a stream on Friday, and I've got a big breakdown of the Henry Novak case and Vikram Digwa's sentencing. That'll be out on Friday at midday. I've got a massive Substack article out that you can go away and read now about the Manchester Airport brawl trial and why it collapsed and what this means for the English legal system. All these are free. You can subscribe to me there, which I really appreciate if you do and financially help me, but they're all free. So go and check them out. Everything I do is free. I've got a stream on Friday and the Nationalist A team on Sunday. I just want to thank again Nativist for being here. Thank you to everyone who donated so generously. Remember, you can subscribe at any time through Substack, and you can donate anytime through crypto as well. So thank you to all those who gave so generously. And finally, thank you to everyone who tuned in tonight. It's been a very powerful show. I hope you all enjoyed it. Anyway, that's it for tonight. Thank you to everyone. Good night. You know I love you all. Stay strong. Keep fighting. And if you go to any of these protests, please, please stay out of trouble. Be respectful. Don't fight with the police. Don't give them a chance to demonize our cause. And never forget, White Lives Matter. We started the fire. Thank you.